Hello, this is Catalin Campano. Welcome to another sponsored interview on the Risky Business News podcast. Today, our guest is Greynose founder Andrew Morris. Welcome, Andrew.
Hey, Catalin. Always good to see you, man. Glad to be here.
The last time you had an extra title in there. You're not CEO anymore.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. I couldn't be happier about it. We've got a new guy and I love working with him. So it's good doing the stuff I'm good at, doing nerd stuff again.
So what happens now? Are you retiring?
No, God, no. There's so much work to be done. Oh my God. No, I get to do what I'm good at. I get to trawl through honeypot data and build the coolest honeypot on planet Earth. So it's pretty cool.
Since we last met, Greynose published a report on the most exploited vulnerabilities last year. Anything interesting in your data?
So there's a couple of things that are interesting, and then there's a few things that are like more of the same or increased. So like the first thing is the amount of time that it takes to iterate on a disclosure to weaponized exploit is just like noticeably shrunk down. So we have like the chart of showing this over time where a vulnerability is disclosed on a certain day, and then we're seeing weaponized exploitation of it the same day. Sometimes we even see it in days prior. So the timeline is getting shorter. That's really interesting. From a like just a trends perspective, we're seeing a lot of OS command injection. We're seeing a lot of like low-hanging fruit bugs for embedded systems, network gear. Yeah, a lot of those different kinds of vulnerabilities are happening. And then from an attacker tactics perspective, we are seeing fewer attackers actually sling an exploit before they've confirmed that the target software is actually running. Whereas, you know, 1, 2, 3 years ago, we used to see attacker automation that would look for just the bare minimum, like this port is open, and then it just slings the exploit. And we're not seeing that anymore. We're seeing that basically attackers are doing more and more validation on the targets before they actually throw the exploit. So our sensors have to get more and more advanced and more believable. We're seeing more and more attackers leveraging the Shodans and the censuses of the world. So like attack surface monitoring tools or like, you know, internet scanning products and stuff like that. We're seeing more and more attackers that are using that kind of stuff. And we see a few times a year mass exploitation events that come exclusively through Tor, which is also interesting in and of itself. Just considering the amount of bandwidth that is used and considering how much that slows down the attack to do the whole thing through Tor is really interesting. So we've seen a few, including, I think, a Confluence vulnerability last year where the attacker was literally spraying millions of exploit requests at the entire internet via Tor exit nodes. So those are some of the patterns that I found to be really interesting.
Are there specific attacks that are being carried out for Tor, or there are typically general in purpose? Like you see only brute force or just exploitation or just...
So in this case, like it's usually a novel exploit. The most recent one was that jumps to mind was this. It was the Confluence vulnerability, the remote code execution that was towards the end of the year last year. Log4j was the same way. The whole first massive wave of exploitation came over Tor. And so I always get this like funny feeling in the back of my mind whenever somebody's doing everything through Tor, because that was something that I saw for the first time with Log4j. And we see it a couple times a year now.
You also said you're seeing a shorter time for exploitation. Did you look into the availability of proof of concept code in those cases?
So it varies. Once proof of concept code is out, that means like weaponization is imminent. Like it's going to happen right now.
But you also see vulnerabilities that are severe enough to warrant attention from the attackers to develop their own exploit threat. That still happens.
Yep.
Okay. Because I wanted to be sure, because there's this trend of blaming people who publish POCs. It's kind of good to remind people that attackers can develop exploits. There are such attackers in the wild still.
And it's funny because a lot of the POCs that you'll see are, it's very clear when the behavior that we're seeing is actually being launched from a public POC that somebody wrote versus like a re-implementation of it. Because they all have their own little foreign accents, you know? Like every POC has its own sort of like idiosyncrasies and nuances in the way that it in the way that it fires traffic across. Sometimes that's a protocol fingerprint. Sometimes that's like a little path or a character. And so, it varies, but yeah, we can always tell when it's the actual POC that's public versus a re-implementation of it.
How often do you see re-implementations? I'm just trying to gauge how many advanced threat actors we have, people capable of actually developing exploits, and how many are 14-year-old kids in their bedrooms trying to get money for Call of Duty skins.
I don't have a good stat for you off the top of my head. A lot of the time, it's actually it's pretty dependent on the bug. I like to try to enter the mind of some of these botnet operators and sort of attackers and to try to figure out what it is that makes a certain vulnerability even more appealing to them. And at the end of the day, it's going to be exploitability, and it's going to be profitability. It's always going to be profitability. How many of these things, how many boxes can you pop with this or whatever? I wish I had a good stat for you on re-implementation, how often we see it. The best thing to do in general is to look at payload variants, so rough shape and size of the payload, the cluster of the attack payload, and then protocol fingerprints are also really useful for figuring this stuff out.
Do you see any general evolution long term compared to 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing more separation of responsibilities in the sort of attack chain. So let's just say 10 years ago, you would do your scanning, your exploitation, and your operations all from the same CIDR block or the same IPs. And now we're seeing much more of that being distributed across several different areas. This is your scanning network, or your scanning hosts are over here. This is your low and slow scanning hosts that are over here. This is the one that's going to do the vuln check. This is the one that's going to sling the exploit. This is where the command and control happens, and this is where you're going to operate from. So we're seeing more and more of that that's sort of exploding out. It makes tracking things a little bit harder. It makes defending against things a little bit harder, but it also creates more sort of little breadcrumbs to trace down what attackers are up to and who they are. So that's one pattern that's been kind of interesting. We see a lot of broken exploits, believe it or not. We aren't really seeing as many now. Sometimes it's like it feels like it's script kiddie stuff. Sometimes it feels like it's like sneaky law enforcement stuff. I don't know, but we're seeing, we still see quite a few sort of broken exploits. And then there's been a bit of a pattern as well of large amounts of spoofed scan traffic that is hitting parts of the internet for reasons that we're still not completely sure why. Usually correlating with, some kind of geopolitical instability or kinetic activity. So it could be distributed denial, like funky distributed denial of services. It could be, types of attacks to knock certain kinds of systems offline. It's unclear to us, but we're seeing more and more of this kind of activity.
Do you see certain autonomous systems being spoofed, or just random things?
We see it seemingly originate from some of the same places. But that's the thing, that's the nature of spoof traffic, is that it's really, really hard to figure out where it's really coming from unless you have a really good map of what's going across the internet.
So you were saying earlier about how attackers have kind of layered their attack infrastructure. I believe this would cause problems to the detection capabilities. And you've said that traffic has evolved, how it looks, how attackers are launching exploits. What are you doing on your side to better detect these attacks? What are the changes that you typically deploy to honeypots? Obviously, if you can say.
I can say. So at the end of the day, there's a few things that you have to worry about when you run a huge honeypot that's sort of the scale that we run it at. One of them is you have to know your sort of, we have to know our attack surface and our operational security sort of kind of like footprint, so to speak. So sometimes it's really important to just ensure that you don't have any sort of consistencies across your sensor footprint. Maybe that's a protocol fingerprint, a TLS fingerprint. Maybe that's a certificate. Maybe that's an SSH key. Maybe it's something like that. And you just want to make sure that you've got a degree of diversity in those things. But at the end of the day, a lot of this comes down to essentially both point of presence entropy, maybe, is the word that I'm looking for. So like point of presence variation and persona variation. And so what that means is you need to be in lots of places and you need to look like lots of things. And if you are in lots of places and you look like lots of things, then that means that you're going to be able to stay in front of it. So then, like in terms of like what you can detect or the level, the degree of advanced stuff that you can detect, that has to do with like how smart your honeypot is, like how much you are willing to deceive, how long you're willing to let the attacker do their thing or whatever. But the most important things for staying ahead of attackers is what you have and what it looks like.
So I'm thinking from an attacker's perspective, like if I know that company A has sensors that live only 1 hour, then they change location, I probably skip on implementing evasion code, right? Because it's probably a waste of time at that point.
Yeah.
So the better you get, the more disinterested they get in evasion and detection, right?
Yeah. You want to just make it so that the shelf life is as short as possible, right? Like the defender wants to make the shelf life of knowing where their honeypots are as short as possible.
And the attacker realizes they're wasting too much time at detection. And just stop doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, they never do. They never just stop. they always come back. They always keep doing it. And the issue is it's automated, you know? Like, a lot of it is automated. So it's just, like, not that much work for them to just keep doing it, right?
So the last time we spoke, you mentioned about working on an AI system for sifting through gray noise network and sensor data. I was wondering, how are you doing this at a technical level? Are you looking for Edmund? That word's hard. Abnormalities in network headers? Are you looking for text for special characters in network traffic? Are you looking at certain fields in TCP packets? Where exactly are you looking for these abnormalities with your AI system?
So the version that we are rolling out right now uses the contents of TCP bodies. And most specifically, we're really focused on HTTP traffic initially, because that's both the most common and it's kind of like the easiest place to start. Other protocols are also very doable with the same sort of approach that we use, but they're just more complicated. And HTTP is like pretty standard and it like makes up the lion's share of the stuff that we actually see on the internet. So what we're doing at a technical level, and my engineers are going to kill me because I'm going to butcher this, but what we're doing at a technical level is we're basically taking, we're plotting the contents of HTTP requests into like a multidimensional array space that is everything that happened today. So you've got your multidimensional array space, and then you've got your kind of like your vectors and such of everything that happened today, but shrunk down into the smallest representation you can possibly get, numbers. And then you're looking at tomorrow and you're comparing it, you're diffing it, right? So everything that has happened tomorrow, you're diffing that, and then you're taking all of the net new things and you're scrubbing out any kind of normal random. So in certain cases, we're gonna see things where there's a lot of variation that are going to be like maybe cookies, session IDs, like things that are normal to be random. And we want to make sure that we can account for that. And then we look at any basically edges, net new cluster members, or rather anything that is of a certain distance away from yesterday. That means a new thing. And then we classify it, right? And then we rank order things in classification. You can use this same approach actually to sift on any different field. It's like completely arbitrary. The optimization takes time. I, for example, would really like to do this approach on something like TCP headers or IP headers and stuff like that, because I think there's a lot of really interesting data in that. But a lot of the time you get a lot more bang for your buck out of doing more simple discrete operations from stuff like that. So HTTP is like a really good place. I think that's a place that makes a lot of sense. And again, it's basically at a technical level, we're basically saying, what is everything that happened today? Make that as small as possible. And then diff that against everything that happens tomorrow. And then classify all the net new things. And then put them in a database so that I can look at them, right? And that's basically how it works under the hood.
Yeah, and I believe you named this system Sift, right?
Yep, it's Sift, and we're using it at work all the time. It's really cool. So the research team uses it to find basically net new things that have ever happened, and we're now producing over double the tag volume that we were producing before without Sift.
This is exactly what I wanted to ask. How was it doing so far?
Sift finds about 100 things per day, give or take. So it's usually between 50 and 200, but it's always around 100. So Sift finds about 100 net new things a day. And of those net new things a day, usually I would say five of them are really interesting. And so then of those five, we might get one to two tags out of it of like things that we can consistently, reliably tag across the whole fleet that's ready to go to a customer and that doesn't have false positives. And so, yeah, I would say that the things that it surfaces are very interesting, but in terms of what we can actually do something with, I would say we get about two per day, two tags per day out of Sift.
And you consider that a success, right?
Oh yeah, are you kidding? Because the cool thing is that it's finding things that we don't find. So in addition to just raw volume, it's also surfacing things that we would have just never noticed. And so we're finding a lot more like sort of hard to locate stuff. It's really cool. So yeah, I would consider Sift a massive success. We don't have any customers that are paying for Sift itself right now, but what they're tagging, the data that it's tagging, is going into the data that a lot of our customers are paying for already. So it's making our product better, and we're rolling it out directly to our customers. I'll share my screen and show it to you. We're rolling out directly to our customers in the next few weeks.
And I think that's a perfect way to end it. Thank you very much.
Catalin, this was awesome, man. I always love talking to you.